Hey colleagues, welcome back to the office, and we are in the office on the road at the moment. Welcome from beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. I'm here this week presenting at a conference for the Scaling New Heights with the Woodard Organization. I'll be teaching tomorrow a variety of the classes that you yourself have come to enjoy through the CPE Today podcast, including our integration and data sharing courses, fraud, and much more. And speaking of fraud, I'm bringing to you a brand new series from CPE Today, the first of a series of podcasts that we're going to do specifically looking at technology and fraud. This is Case Studies in Fraud and Technology Controls, Part 1. In this course, we're going to be looking at the relationship between technology and fraud, and believe it or not, they go hand in hand in so many different ways. So many different types of fraud can be prevented with effective and useful technology controls, and technology can be a great way of being able to deter, detect, and prevent so many different bad potential frauds occurring inside of our organization. In the first part, in today's class, what we're going to be looking at is fraud in America today. I'm going to be bringing to you some of the most recent findings from the American Institute of Certified Fraud Examiners. I think that's the name, AIFCE, I think. Their reports to the nations on most occupational fraud that has occurred recently. They put together this report regularly looking at different frauds that have occurred throughout the United States. And I think there's actually some international as well, now that I'm thinking about it, but helping us to kind of understand where and how fraud occurs. You know, it's so pervasive, it's so large. Unfortunately, there's a lot of economic indicators that are showing that it's trending upwards in some particular instances. So as a CPA, as a financial professional, we need to be vigilant. We need to be on the lookout for this. So in our first part today, what we're going to look at is some of the major findings of this. We're going to look at, for example, some of the main components of how these frauds occur. We're going to talk about, for example, some of the major types and categories of people. For example, we'll look at, you know, what type of fraud, frequency, months to detect, how long the perpetrator has been there, and more. I'll also introduce some of the main topics around fraud, including the fraud triangle, opportunity, rationalization, pressure. You know, these three things are prevalent really kind of in every fraud and help us understand why fraud occurs, as well as some of the commonalities of fraud. I'm also going to show you some of the techniques within QuickBooks Online that I think are effective, and these principles can be applied to any accounting system to help prevent fraud from occurring and hopefully improve your overall internal controls. So all that and more in future episodes. We're going to dive deep into the specific technology controls, looking at general controls, application controls, technology controls galore. There's so much and more to explore. So I'm really looking forward to getting this series kicked off. Now, before we get started, as with all of our classes, I do want to remind you that the CPE Today podcast is eligible for CPE credit. If you happen to be a financial professional, and I hope you are, you can earn credits by watching or listening to today's podcast. It's super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com. Take a short 5-question quiz, and you'll earn a credit for today's course. Today's class code is CSF1. So you can just type that in the search bar, and this will pop up right for you. 5 questions, you're in and out, you get another credit. So if you enjoy our content, it's a great way to support the channel and help us in terms of being able to produce more content for you. And besides our podcast, we've got hundreds of other courses and all variety of topics. It's everything you might need to be on top of your game as being a financial professional. So we're going to get started here with our class, and at the end of our presentation today, I'll join you back for 3 quick review questions and then wrap up. Thanks for being here, folks, and enjoy. We're going to start our presentation with a discussion of the current state of affairs, and I'd like to always start this section of the presentation with a quote from my man Sophocles. I'd rather fail with honor than succeed with fraud. Unfortunately, in America today, we have this constant pressure that whatever it takes, we will do whatever it takes, we will succeed. And unfortunately, you know, with some organizations where they get into themselves into trouble is that whatever it takes attitude sometimes spills over into whatever it takes, rather than whatever it takes to do whatever we're trying to achieve legally. Unfortunately, you know, we're driven a lot by consumerism with success and being successful with respect to the work that we're doing. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. However, where it does become a bad thing is that when we prioritize financial success over the well-being and stability of our organizations.
virtually all fraud can be summarized and explained in the context of the fraud triangle. And this should be no surprise to you with respect to how fraud occurs. But we see these three elements that are always present in every type of fraud. There's some sort of opportunity, there's some sort of motivation, and there's some sort of rationalization. And if we look at, for example, the different examples of fraud that we're going to discuss today, there's always the same scenario. You know, somebody had some sort of motivation or pressure, and it could be, you know, a real thing like a sick family member, or it could be something self-imposed, maybe like a gambling debt or substance abuse or something like that. Well, that's going to cause some sort of pressure that's going to require that person to maybe act extraordinarily from what they would normally do, you know, and that's when fraud might occur. Well, what do people end up stealing? Well, they always steal whatever they have the opportunity to, you know, and so that opportunity would be whatever they have access to. You know, if they're a shop clerk for that matter, it might be, for example, stealing inventory. If they are a corporate executive, and it might be, for example, doing a material misstatement on a financial statement to overstate earnings to maybe pump up the stock and then cash in some stock options or something like that. Or it could be something as simple as just stealing cash, writing fictitious checks to vendors that don't exist or something like that. They will exploit whatever opportunity is available to them. Then there's going to be some sort of rationalization, because a good sane person just can't do this in good conscience. You know, they have to justify why they are doing something in order to fit the narrative in their head of being a good person. You know, and it might be something like, I've worked here for 20 years and I've been passed over by management 100 times for a promotion. Or, you know, the owner of the company is always gone. And I'm the one really running this. And it's as much as mine as it is that person's. Or it might be, it's only a loan. You know, man, I just need to get through this hard time, but I'll pay it back. I promise I will. You know, and then $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 later, it becomes something that is more of an addiction than anything else. In a lot of these instances, as we look at the people who actually commit the fraud, almost in all circumstances, they get very bold in subsequent frauds that they do. Very rarely is it a one-time thing. In almost all circumstances, they get a taste. That taste turns into addiction. And the more that they take, the more they become resentful of the actual people and companies that they're working with. They end up taking more and more. Now, fraud always has these four commonalities. Okay, by design, the acts are clandestine. You know, there's nobody that gets a job description that is that includes fraud. You know, with respect to what they are doing here, you know, nobody is going to, for example, get a job description that says, you know, you're an accounts payable clerk, and at the same time, you're also supposed to be committing fraud against the company. No, you know, fraud always occurs in the dead of night. It always occurs when people are least expecting it. It always occurs when there's a breakdown of internal controls and people have some sort of opportunity to be able to take advantage of the company. But by design, these acts are not public. They are not seen in the cleansing light of day. Okay. Fraud always violates the perpetrator's obligations and fiduciary responsibilities to the organization and positions of trust within the organization. Okay, again, there's nobody in the history of companies that has ever committed fraud and the employer's like, you know what, good job. That's exactly what we wanted you to do. But rather, we're exacting a cost. We're exacting a fee. We're exacting a price that somebody is going to pay. Most often, it will be that organization, although it can be indirect as well. Now, fraud by design also will be done for some sort of enrichment, whether it be direct, you know, in terms of direct financial compensation, or some sort of indirect. You know, it could be kickbacks. It could be some sort of advantage that you're gaining over somebody else. It might not be monetary, but in most opportunities and in most examples, it actually is. So by design, fraud is clandestine. It violates our obligations and positions of trust inside the organization. The activities are committed for some sort of enrichment, directly or indirectly, and they exact some sort of cost. Now, the sad truth is, in virtually pretty much every topic a fraud is, and there's been tons of different studies on this, that fraud is pretty widespread across not only the United States, but really in the world and across all different types and categories of business. It's not a problem for small business exclusively or a problem for big business exclusively, but rather all businesses of all types. So whether you're a mom-and-pop shop running a pizza parlor in town or you are a Fortune 500 organization, this is something that you need to consider in with respect to your companies, because it's something that we all deal with in some capacities one way or the other. And if we're not dealing with it, well, you know what? Then that's a good chance that we will become victims of fraud ourselves. Lots of estimates, you know, from the American Institute of Certified Fraud Examiners, as well as the AICPA and others, peg fraud losses anywhere from 5 to 8% of the total organizational revenues, which is just absolutely incredible when you think about, let's say, a company like Apple, how many billions of dollars that might mean to an organization, you know, or even small companies that maybe don't have two pennies to rub together, you know, that might have a shop clerk or a staff member stealing from them, that could seriously affect and hurt the longevity and the ability for that company to be able to operate. Now, be aware that there's differences between the numbers as well as types of fraud based off of the size of the organization that is affected by this, you know. So, you know, for a company like Apple, you know, somebody stealing, you know, $1,000 is a completely immaterial. I bet even, you know, $1 million could be immaterial, although fraud of any dollar value is wrong. Now, we're supposed to have internal controls, right? Internal controls are supposed to be there. We spend so much time designing these controls, implementing these controls, monitoring these controls, refining how they work and function, that aren't these things supposed to be here to prevent this from occurring? Well, the answer is yes, they are, but they're not as effective as they could be. You know, internal controls, while a necessary component of any business, is not necessarily going to eliminate the risk of fraud inside of a company. Remember, internal controls are there to mitigate and to bring the risk down to an acceptable level with inside the company. Now, there are five interrelated internal controls components that we should be aware of. Okay, we have our risk assessment. You know, with our risk assessment, what we are essentially doing is that we are looking at the environment and we are trying to understand and determine where fraud might occur for this particular company. And that fraud, for example, could occur, you know, if it is a manufacturing company, it could be in the theft of raw materials. If it is a retail organization, it could be the theft of inventory. If it's a professional service firm, it could be theft of money through accounts payable fraud, or it could be theft of information where somebody takes information and goes and starts a rival business or goes to a competitor. Well, then we need to look at our control environment. You know, how can we essentially design the environment for these controls to work effectively? And what kind of things are we putting in place that can help mitigate fraud inside of this? And what is the overall way of this company operating? You know, is, for example, fraud and controls taken very seriously at the top, or is it kind of loosey-goosey, or maybe somewhere in between? And, you know, what type of systems do we have in place to monitor and track data and people and other things inside the company? We have our control activities, which are going to be the things that we can actually do to help reduce fraud risk inside of our company. And these are broken down into four main categories: our preventative controls, our detective controls, deterrence controls, as well as compensating. More on that here in a moment. We need a variety of information and communication tools and techniques to be able to gather information so that we can be able to monitor and be able to get enough information to make decisions on whether or not what we're doing is effective. Now, we have these control activities, okay? These control activities are designed in these four main categories. We have preventive controls, we have detective controls, we have deterrent and compensating controls. Okay. Now, our preventative controls are activities in which we engage in attempt to prevent undesirable actions or outcomes. Okay. So in this particular way, we might have, you know, like a good employee handbook that might have some specific guidance on what you can and cannot do. Well, it's there to educate our staff to prevent some sort of unwanted action or outcome. And, you know, it could be something as simple as don't steal, you know. But as long as we tell people what we're expecting, you know, we can keep people all on the same page. And by being on the same page, we can hold people accountable. Now we have detective controls. These are measures and controls that we put in place to let us know on a timely basis that an intended result is not being achieved. Detective controls help notify us in the event that fraud does occur that we can do something about it before it becomes a major issue inside of the company. Okay, we have deterrent controls. These are actions which occur with the intended purpose of discouraging that non-desired behavior. And this could be something like an employee write-up for not following the written procedures with respect to what to expect inside of an organization. You know, so if people feel that there are repercussions, if they feel that there are negative outcomes that could occur, well, you know, hopefully that would be enough to deter whatever action that might be. And that could be everything from, you know, hey, we prosecute all crimes regardless of who contributes them. Or it could be that regardless of the amount stolen, it results in immediate termination from the company. Either way, in terms of what we do, those would result in a termination of that employee, regardless if it's the CEO or the intern. Now we have compensating controls. Now these are for the express purpose of putting in additional controls where we know controls by design are going to be weak. And so it's a way of putting in additional security inside of our organization when we know that something that we're going to do isn't going to be enough. And so it's a way of, again, mitigating risk to a more acceptable manner. Now let's go ahead and take a look at some of the results and some of the findings from the American Association of Certified Fraud Examiners. Now, the numbers and statistics that we're going to look at here come from their 2008 report to the Nations for Occupational Fraud and Abuse. This report is a report that's put out every 2 years by the AFCE, which discusses and examines how fraud occurs inside of an organization, with the intention of highlighting certain types of fraud, why it occurs, to give people the necessary insight to hopefully reduce and bring it to manageable levels inside of their companies. So some of the macro level things from their report, according to them, 5% of all business revenues are consumed by fraud. Annual occupational fraud exceeds $4 trillion worldwide, and about $1 trillion here just in the good old United States. And on a per employee basis, it's about $7,300 here in the United States. That's absolutely incredible. 5% of all revenues, you know, and up to $4 trillion worldwide. So as we look through this particular report, what we're going to go ahead and see here is the role of that particular person inside of the company, the tenure of that person inside the company, whether or not this was their first time doing something like this, and a lot more. And as we kind of talk through this, I'd encourage you, go ahead and share with me some of your thoughts, your comments, and I'll share them with the audience on some of the experiences that you've seen in the companies that you work with. So a question that usually gets popped up here is who is committing these frauds? You know, we tend to focus on, you know, a lot of employees, and certainly employee theft is quite large. However, if we look at in terms of dollar value lost, it's quite minor. Okay. What you should know when you're reading these charts here, that on the left-hand side, we have frequency of occurrence, and on the right-hand side, we have dollar value lost. So if we look at frequency of occurrence, employee fraud is quite large. It's about 44%, you know, so it happens much more often, you know, but if we look up here at the top end of the pyramid, owner executive fraud represents about 20% of occurrence, but man, is it expensive at about $850,000 average loss per incident. So a question you should be thinking about yourself, I mean, with half of all frauds occurring with owners and senior executives, what's the impact of our internal control environment? You know, think about it. Internal controls can be immediately circumvented if you're in a position of privilege inside of a company. You know, if you're an owner, you know, if you're a manager, you know, you can circumvent these things. These, you have access, you have the ability to not only get into the information systems that can make this possible, but you also can design around it too. You know, if the person designing the internal control environment is the one committing fraud, of course, they're going to work around whatever controls they put in place. So I'll share with you some different stories throughout the presentation here. But one story that comes to mind, you know, kind of speaking to how owners can steal from themselves, was a story shared with me by an attendee from a couple years ago. So if you think back to, you know, the 2007, 2008 financial crisis, you know, everything was really kind of crazy and in flux, very similar to what we see today in the COVID world, but, you know, minus the worldwide pandemic of where we were. So this attendee had a client that was a trucking company, and this particular company had a trucking company that owns several different types of trucks. And, you know, one of the things that you can look for in terms of the health of the company is how much freight is moving across the country, whether it be on trains or on trucks. And this company did something that was very wrong. What they ended up doing was they wanted to expand the organization. And this was in 2007, before the actual crash occurred. And so they went out to a bank and they got a line of credit based off of their current receivables, which were pretty high at the time. And then what they did, which you shouldn't do, is they took something that's essentially a short-term liability and they bought fixed assets with it, a long-term asset. Well, when the economy, you know, took a downturn in 2008, the bank called in their line of credit and said, hey, you know, it's time to pay the piper. You owe us. Okay. Well, what ended up happening was that company had spent this money and they didn't have the business anymore to be able to justify having that line of credit. And they weren't in a position to be able to pay it back immediately because, again, they'd sunk their money into these fixed assets that are just kind of sitting around waiting to be used. Well, what the owner ended up doing was that in order to keep receivables high, to keep the bank at bay, he started a second QuickBooks account. Okay. He was depositing checks into one account, but he wasn't putting them into QuickBooks. He opened a bank account at another bank and basically was keeping the money to himself to keep his receivable high. Okay. The attendee that I was speaking to regarding this said that everything was fine until, you know, the bookkeeper quit. Okay. And that's always usually a pretty good sign of when something is going to go poorly. So they called this person. This person came over, took a look at the books, and apparently the owner of this trucking company boldly told the accountant about this scheme and didn't put two and two together that what he was doing was essentially committing fraud. Okay. Well, the short story of this, you know, this person ended up having to declare bankruptcy, lost his business, and also getting criminally prosecuted, although did not face any actual jail time as it was under $1 million and the prosecutor declined to sue criminally. But we need to be aware of, for example, even when our clients are, when they're stealing from themselves, and fraud is fraud no matter what way you cut it. Let's take a look at the time period for a perpetrator. Okay. Well, if we look at when fraud occurs, we tend to be overly skeptical, for example, of new hires. Okay. Only 9% of fraud occurs from people who have been with the business for less than a year. You know, so this idea that we just hired somebody and we need to put an extra pair of eyes on them is kind of lost in the sense that people who are new to a company rarely are in a position, or nor do they have the access to be able to commit large scale fraud. You know, if we look instead for people who've been with the company a long time, 10 years or longer, not only is it greater in terms of frequency, the dollar lost is certainly larger. With people being at the company for over 10 years, they've essentially cased the joint. They know exactly what to do. They know where all the soft spots are of the company. They know what people are looking for and not looking for, and they know how to exploit the weaknesses. So with people that have been with the company over 10 years, you know, the average loss is about $250K, which is pretty substantial. and everything in between, you know, going up. You know, the longer you are with a company, generally we see a larger amount of dollar loss of fraud. And we also see the frequency of that going in. Most fraud occurs with companies that have been for the business anywhere from 1 to 5 years. We can see that's just about half or so. And in fact, if we pull together our 1 to 5 years, that's about 50% overall. Now, this kind of makes sense. I mean, if you think about business in general, you get to know people, they get to know you, you spend more time with your coworkers, everybody becomes friends. And again, you kind of let your guard down overall with respect to where this business is going and you know, and who's in charge. I mean, you know, you couldn't possibly be Bob. I've known Bob for 20 years. I went to his kid's high school graduation. I was at his wedding. And it's pretty common, for example, when people get hired, you know, they get hired for one job and they end up growing into another. That's pretty common overall. And with respect to this, we tend to put trust into people the more and more we get to know them and we give them more and more responsibility. You know, there are plenty of examples of business managers who aren't owners in the company, but yet have signatory privileges on the company's checking account. The more trust we have in a person, the bigger opportunity that person has for fraud. The newer they are to the organization, we don't know them, we don't give them a lot of trust, don't give them enough rope to hang themselves, and generally there's lower risk. One of the best things you can do with respect to people in your organization, as much as you can, get up and move around, you know, in the corporate structure. You know, every couple of years, shake things up a little bit, move people around, report to different folks. Not only is it a great way of being able to cross-train and build resilience in your company using your existing staff, but it's also a great way of determining what's working and what's not working inside of your company, okay? And if people know that they could be picked up and moved from one department to the other or report to somebody else or their duties essentially can be audited and reviewed, you know, it's going to help keep people on their toes and it might help overall reduce your organization's risk and for fraud and for, you know, somebody basically sticking around for long enough to figure out how to be able to exploit the company's weaknesses. Now, let's take a look at how long it takes to detect fraud. You know, we tend to put a lot of effort into detective controls, trying to figure out essentially when fraud occurs and being able to reduce our risk and exposure to it. But if we look at this, most fraud goes on for a pretty significant period of time. Okay, so if we look at this as an example here from our owners and executives, well, guess what? You know, they're in a position of privilege. They're in a position of authority within the company. They're able to exploit that position of privilege, and they're able to commit fraud for a very long period of time, usually more than a year, up to 2 years, versus our employees, which, you know what? They really can't commit that fraud for that long of a basis. Usually the most they can go for is about a year. Well, why? You know, well, the reason why is because, again, they're not usually in a position to be able to conceal it. You know, if they're a standard employee and let's just say they are stealing inventory, well, at some point we should be doing a inventory count inside of our company and comparing those records against what the physical inventory might be. You know, so if they're stealing finished goods or they're stealing raw materials, at some point somebody should figure it out as a component of either the review or that financial statement preparation. Now, managers, though, they can go on a little bit longer. Why? Because they might be able to control their little fiefdom a little bit better than what we could see than with a standard employee. But typically, even your managers can't go on forever with respect to not getting caught. So some other stories I might share with you here. I got a story. This also came from an attendee, and this came from a CPA in the Arizona area that had a client that was an electrical contracting firm. Now, this firm had three owners. One owner focused on sales, one owner focused on operations, and one owner focused on engineering. Okay, so this story occurs prior to 2006. And the reason that's important is that in 2006, QuickBooks turned on a feature by default, which was the audit trail functionality. Now, any reputable accounting software now should have an audit trail function. And an audit trail, what is the function that allows you to be able to go back and look at a transaction and look at all previous versions of that particular transaction? So if a transaction changes, you'll know about it. Okay. So, you know, somebody changes the name on a check, changes the amount on a check, or something like that. These solutions, as part of their database, retain that knowledge and will display that to you if you run a report called an audit trail exceptions report. Well, prior to 2006, this feature was not enabled. And in fact, in subsequent updates for QuickBooks, it not only was enabled, but it could not be turned off, which I applaud Intuit's intuition for doing something like that, because that one little report, you know, it's incredible how many small little things that if we just did this one thing, we can significantly reduce, if not eliminate, our risk for fraud or misappropriation inside of our company. But that little one thing, if you check it, there's a good chance you'll, and there is fraud occurring in your organization, it'll probably appear there. We tend to put a lot of emphasis on people stealing cash, you know, and the reality is most fraud occurs in the information systems and occurs in payables, you know, and if we check the audit trails exceptions report, we'll get some pretty good insight with respect to what is going on in our companies and when there are exceptions to things, you know, and I can't think of a good reason why you'd ever change the name of a check after you've written it. So looking at that report can be really helpful. All right, back to our regular scheduled program. So this occurred probably like 2003, four, somewhere in that range. This electrical contracting firm hired a new bookkeeper, and that bookkeeper told the owner that she could work a heck of a lot faster if they turned off this pesky little audit trail function. I know that would be horrible, wouldn't it? You know, just the lines that people will tell people to get them to do something, unfortunately, is pretty easy, especially if you're not familiar with how some of the software operates. You could quickly make a really, really bad decision like that. So they turned off this audit trail report. Essentially, she had unlimited access and there was no way they could track the transactions that were inside of this report. She basically told them, if you turn it off, I can work a lot faster. Well, she ended up committing accounts payable fraud. She ended up purchasing almost $60,000 of computers from Dell and sold them out of the back of her car at a local community college. Well, what ended up happening and the way it was discovered was that she didn't show up to work one day. You know, up to this point, she was the model employee. She was always there early. She stayed late. She worked on weekends. She answered the phone on the first ring. You know, and that's always suspect. When people are that good at their jobs, that always makes me a little bit nervous, you know, or maybe it makes me feel a little inadequate. Maybe a little of column A and a little of column B. But this person didn't show up to work one day. And Dell called up, came to complain about, hey, why aren't we getting paid here? And the owner answered the phone. They went back and forth. You know, the owner said, well, send me the POs so I can see essentially what was purchased. And, you know, if we pay you, we'll pay you. Well, they ended up faxing over these POs and this person's name appeared on every one of them on the POs and the invoices. And this person was purchasing them in the name of the company using the line of credit that this company had with Dell and having all the computers. You know, I can't make this stuff up. They were being shipped directly to her house, you know? So post story to this, she ended up getting arrested. However, the litigation for this really wasn't against her. It ended up being against the employment company that this person came from as a recommendation. You know, this employment company was supposed to do a due diligence and a background check on this person. They never actually did it. This person was already a felon for committing felony larceny in Colorado just the year before. So, you know, stuff like this happens all the time, you know, and unfortunately, you know, we need to have a really good proactive approach with respect to bringing people in our company. Because once they're in, I mean, it could be very difficult to get them removed. And also we have a tendency to kind of drop our guard once somebody is on our team. Okay. So question I ask here is, fraud is increasing. If so, what are we going to do about it? You know, can we increase our internal controls? You know, I think that'll only really kind of get us too far. What I really think we need is a better balanced system of internal controls. We need, you know, all of them, preventative, detective, deterring, compensating, not just solely focusing on preventative and, you know, deterring. I mean, we need to have better detective tools. You know, the detective tools that we are designing, I mean, frankly, aren't that great. How can something be considered effective if the longest period of time could be 2 years before actually determining that works. Additionally, I think we also put a little bit too much emphasis on these preventative controls. You know, frankly, I think we need a better balance between them. And, you know, whenever possible, I think we need to incorporate, you know, all four and not just put all of our eggs in one basket. So the next question that we might want to ask ourselves, what about collusion? You know, how often are these going to be one person versus multiple people? Well, it's kind of straight down the middle here. You know, if we look at frauds occurring, about half the time they are individuals and about half the time they are groups of people. Now, in almost all circumstances, the amount of fraud loss goes up with the number of perpetrators included. So if you happen to have, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 people, the more people involved, the amount of money lost or compromised will certainly go up. You know why? Because, you know, you got to pay for these additional folks to be involved here. So collusion by design is just when you have two people working together on something, you know, and by design, collusion is very, very, very difficult to be able to, very, very difficult to be able to detect. And if you got two people, in almost all circumstances, you can circumvent internal controls, especially if they're two different organizations, or especially if they're at two different levels of the company. You know, if I'm, for example, the controller and I'm colluding with the bank, ooh, man, I mean, there's, I don't know how you'd possibly be able to get around that. You know, or if I am, let's say, the purchasing manager and I am colluding with the vendor of some sort, again, I don't know how you'd be able to circumvent that. That could be very hard to be able to detect and very hard to be able to prevent happening as well. And there's all different types of, you know, fraud, whether it be, you know, for example, kickback schemes or direct financial compensation for services, or not even something as simple as maybe trying to get the best rate for a company and for our client. So there was actually a recent, really good recent example of this. There's a company called Utz Quality Food, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with Utz. You know, they make delicious, delicious carbohydrates of my favorite type, pretzels. And Utz, unfortunately, recently had a fraud occur with them where they had almost $1.5 million stolen through a kickback scheme. Okay. And this involves somebody inside the Utz purchasing department and a vendor, and if, you know, that was essentially colluding with this person. They issued Utz falsely issued 40 fake purchase orders for stuff they never actually received. These went to a vendor who never actually delivered the good, and they were able to kind of play both companies, you know, against each other, and ultimately received about $1.5 million of fraudulent funds. So, you know, if this company had better internal controls, they might have been able to prevent something like that from happening. Let me show you and give you an example how of some of this might occur. Let's take a look at, for example, our audit trail functionality inside of QuickBooks Online, just as a simple example here. So I'm running the QuickBooks test drive file, which is Craig's Design and Landscaping Services. If you just Google QBO test drive, you can try this out for yourself. And I just want to point out audit trails, where they might live and generally what they might look like. Okay. Now, if we switch over here down to our reports view, okay, and if we just search for this report over here, we will see that there is this audit log, as they call it here in QuickBooks. And this audit log is a log of all transactions that have occurred inside of this account. Now, one of the cool things about these SaaS-based solutions is there is zero opportunity for anybody, for that matter, to be able to adjust how this file operates or how QuickBooks operates. Intuit controls all aspects of the user experience here, including logging all systems actions. So if I, for example, come in and I log into the system, you're going to see those actions occur here. And if I change anything, we would see those actions occur as well. Now, one of the most common things that people will do is they will change checks. Again, we tend to put a little bit too much emphasis on accounts receivable when really I think the emphasis should be on accounts payable. One of the most common things that they will do is that they will write a check to themselves, and then they will change the name of the check after they've cashed that check. So as an example here, let's go ahead and create a vendor. Let's call it Steve Co. Industries. Okay. And we're going to go ahead and save this as a vendor here. Okay, and we're going to write a check. And what they will typically do is they will look at the chart and they will find something that's pretty easy to be able to dump some money in. And that expense would go relatively unnoticed. And so for a lot of organizations, that would be cost of goods sold, or it could be my personal favorite, supplies. Okay. So you know what? I've worked here. I've been the controller for Craig's landscaping service for a long time. And you know what? Craig has overlooked me for my promotion consistently since I started here. You know, I should be chief landscaper now. And you know what? I've taken over his accounting system and as part of my duties, and I'm going to give myself a nice bonus of $1,500. And we'll go ahead and save and close this. Let's go ahead and actually give the check date of the 31st. And we're going to go ahead and select save and close. Okay. So I would then print that check. I would then go take that check to my bank. I would cash that check. And it's important to note, increasingly, even though things and services like online banking are becoming even more ubiquitous and even more widespread and available, less and less are we actually looking at the actual checks themselves. Very less and less are we actually examining the actual checks to see what they say and who they are written out to. You know, in the old days, we used to get an envelope full of canceled checks at the end of the period. And frankly, that just doesn't happen anymore. Okay. So with respect to this, we don't actually look and see where these checks are. You know, we don't actually see what these checks are coming back as. Likewise, we don't actually look at the EFTs nearly as much. They can be very ambiguous when we look at an ACH transaction. And on that ACH transaction, you know, it can be pretty ambiguous of what it is. It could say something like service fees, or, you know, rarely does it actually tell us exactly what somebody did. Well, what they would end up doing is they would come over here after the fact that they have written that check. They cash that thing. And then in order to not be discovered, they would go and change the name and probably delete the vendor as associated with it as well. So here, we'll come over here. We've already printed our check. And instead of this being Steve Co. Industries, let's just pick something else. Let's pick Lumber Building Supplies. And we're going to go ahead and select save and close. Okay. And then now if we were to go print that check again, or if we were to go look at that check again, it wouldn't say my name, but rather it would say Norton Lumber Supplies, indicating that that is who that check is from. And unless I physically had that check in my possession, it'd be really kind of hard for me to see, because all the numbers, the amounts, and everything else are going to match. And so if we go and we look at our audit trail report, and this may or may not work because this is a sample file here, but hopefully it does. Let's see our audit log. Okay. And in fact, we do see this. And so what we can see here in our audit log is that we can actually see that certain things happen on certain dates and times. So we can see here on June 10th. Okay. The user logged in was Craig Carlson. He created a vendor called Steve Co. Industries. He created check number 71 for $1,500. Okay. And as we kind of look through over here, we'll actually see that Craig Carlson edited that check and changed it to a different person. If we click on the history of this, we can actually see the nature of this transaction, and we can compare this line by line. And we can see that, you know, went from the printed stage to the editing stage. And if we look at this, we will actually see that the name of this check changed from one to the other. Likewise, if we click into the actual check itself and we click down here to more, we can see this transaction journal as well as the audit history of this particular transaction. We can see, and that's a quick way of being able to get access to this info. And so this is the great way of being able to track. This data cannot be adjusted, cannot be modified, cannot be otherwise changed to anything else. Okay. So once this information is committed to QuickBooks, it's there forever. Okay. Likewise, if we come over here and we delete this vendor, let's go try deleting that real quick. Okay. We'll come over here to Steve Co. Industries, and we're going to go ahead and delete this terrible vendor. Okay. Let's see, batch actions. Let's see, go back one actually. Come on. There we go. I think I need to scroll down here. Here's Steve Co. Okay. And we're going to come over here and we're going to go ahead. Oh, wait a minute, you can't delete things. In QuickBooks Online and many of these other accounting solutions, Dynamics, Acumatica, many others, it's perpetual. You can make something inactive, but you can't delete it. Once something is created inside of one of these solutions, it's there forever. You know, and if we choose, for example, to make this client inactive or this vendor inactive, okay, it's still there. Okay, if we come over here to the right-hand side, okay, you'll see that there's this option that says include inactive. And the takeaway from this is that nothing in most accounting solutions ever is actually deleted. It's only what we call logically removed. We're just not currently in that display. So by design, these cloud applications are so much more secure and better secure from an internal controls perspective than what we would ever get with on-premise technology, because we don't have access to modify anything with respect to QuickBooks. Now, there's one other thing I want to show you with respect to any accounting solution. It doesn't matter what we end up going with here, but rather a feature that is in any qualified accounting solution, which is the closing date. Okay, so if we come up here to accounts and settings, and then we come down to our accounting settings on the left-hand side here, which are in our advanced menu tab. There we go. Under our accounting settings here, what I want to draw your attention to is this option right here that says close the books. Okay, right now it's set to off. One of the things I hate about QuickBooks the most, and doesn't matter if you're running QuickBooks Enterprise or QuickBooks Desktop or QuickBooks Online, is they don't follow accounting periods. It's everything is transactional date-based. So you could post anything you want into whatever period you want. Well, one of the best things you could possibly do to help reduce risk and exposure is to close your books on a regular basis. Go ahead and slide that little option right here. Turn that guy on, give yourself a closing date, let's say of June 1st or May 31st, whatever you'd like. Okay. And then you have a couple of options. You can, for example, allow changes, but give that person a warning. It's like a nice slap on the wrist, does nothing for you. Or what I would recommend, allow changes after a warning and entering a password. And this is different than the password for the actual file itself. This would be something, for example, that the controller, CFO, CEO would do. Now, granted, if they're the ones committing the fraud, it doesn't really help you, but this would help, for example, against normal staff. But this little small thing right here, it's one of the absolute best things you could possibly do to reduce your overall risk and exposure. So, as much as you can, I'd recommend that you close your books on a fairly regular process.
All right, colleagues, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed our presentation and discussion on the first section for case studies and analyzing fraud. There's so much more great material to come in terms of how we can help reduce this serious risk to our organizations. It's a real threat to America, to the world, to business today, as well as into the future. Let's go ahead and have our three reviewing questions, and then we'll go ahead and wrap up for the day. Our first review question, how much do fraud losses cost companies in their revenues? And so obviously we have to kind of back into this, you know, we have to make some guesses here. But according to the report that we were looking at, was it 3-5%? Nah, I wish it was that little. Is it 8-10%? Thankfully it's not that high. The correct answer here is going to be 5-8%, which is still incredible. I mean, you think of the U.S. GDP and what 5% could do. I mean, that is truly astounding in terms of what it actually does cost. And you know what? It very well might be much higher than that if we were to actually be able to quantify everything at a really material level. Our second review question. Which of the following is part of the interrelated internal control cycle? So which of these things are going to be part of that interrelated series of internal controls? Is it risk assessment? Absolutely it is. Is it monitoring? You betcha. I mean, it's always best to be able to monitor and kind of review these things to have a pretty good understanding of what's going on. If you're not monitoring, you're not being able to determine what's going to occur in the future. Is it control activities? Absolutely it is. So the correct answer here is all of the above. All of these are part of that internal control cycle. Assess the risk. You want to monitor, make some changes, understand how those changes affect, put in some control activities as well. So the correct answer here is going to be all of the above. Our third question, All right, our third question here. Which group of fraud perpetrators has the greatest economic impact? Well, let's think about this. Is it going to be employees? Probably not. Employees are only going to steal what they have access to. If they don't have access to large quantities of money or, getting paid off profit, there's only so much damage they could do. So they're probably not the largest impact. Is it managers? Well, they're definitely one for corruption. That's something that could definitely occur with a manager, but again, they're kind of limited. Correct answer here is going to be owners and executives. They're paid off a profit. They have the means to be able to conceal their fraud for a longer period of time. They have greater access, greater motivation. Frankly, it's kind of endless in terms of what they could do. So the correct answer here again is owners, executives, and sadly, those are the frauds that are probably going to be the most damaging and hurtful now as well as in the future. So, as I mentioned, we're starting a new series here. The next series, next episode of this is going to be coming up shortly, and we're going to continue our discussion and review, looking through and continuing our discussion on the Report to the Nations in Understanding Fraud in America Today. Then we're going to go ahead and dive through the technology controls and general controls. If we don't have general controls, we really can't build any sort of trust inside of an organization. So we'll talk about what they are and what you can do to improve those in your organizations, and then building upon that, both technology as well as application controls. So lots more to come within here, and we're going to go ahead and discuss all the different things that at least I can think of that will hopefully make you better, safer, more secure, and reduce your risk of fraud and promote better internal controls inside your organization. Now, before I go, I do want to remind you again, you can get credit for watching and listening to today's class. Super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com. Today's course code is CSF1. 5-question quiz. You'll bang that out in about 2 minutes. You'll earn a credit for today's class. And besides our podcast, we've got classes in all different types of education, accounting, audit, personal development, finance, and more. Everything you need to know to stay on top of your game. If you enjoy our content, it's a great way of being able to support the channel. Please consider reaching out and connecting with us on social media. You can find us almost on every social media out there at CPE Today, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and more. And as always, you can watch our show live. We're usually try to come to you twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays. But if you can't catch us live, you can catch us on your own time, wherever you happen to get your content, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and more. It's my absolute pleasure being with you here, folks, and I look forward to seeing you back in the office the next time around. Take care and good luck. Hey, colleagues, welcome back to the office, and we are in the office on the road at the moment. Welcome from beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. I'm here this week presenting at a conference for the Scaling New Heights with the Woodard Organization. I'll be teaching.